thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 68 for the 4th of April, 2011. OMG, no GBS. Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of the Digital Campus podcast, broadcasting on a slightly overcast and drizzly cold day in Fairfax, Virginia, here at the Center for History and New Media. And we are here with our regulars, although we're distributed around the globe today, or around campus, as the case may be, with Mills Kelly. Mills, how are you?
I'm doing just great. How are you, Dan?
Good. Very good. Mills, of course, blogs at the wonderful edwired.org and is not on Twitter.
That's exactly right.
Amanda French is with us from Rexford, New York. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Dan.
Good to have you back. Hope you're doing well.
Yes.
And from the Center for History and New Media's favorite Starbucks in Enfield, Connecticut, is Tom Scheinfeld. Hey, Tom.
Hi, everybody. Just back from a long visit to the DMV, so relieved to be here at Starbucks having a coffee, talking to all of you.
It seems like 2011, shouldn't there be a DMV app for Android and iPhone? Whoever could come up with that could make a considerable amount of money, I think.
I think there also needs to be a Jump My Car Battery app for the iPhone.
You're having car trouble?
No, a friend of mine earlier tweeted that remark that his car battery died, and amazingly enough, there was not an app for that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it is getting to the sad point where I look at my iPhone for pretty much anything. You know, I'm like waiting in line, and I'm thinking, well, what could the iPhone do for me now to make my life better? That's sort of sad, isn't it?
Yes, it's very sad, Dan.
It is sad. I mean, I do the same thing.
That was so sad I couldn't even comment on it.
Well, we are. We should move on to the news, shouldn't we? For my sad life, let's dig in. Boy, at least two very meaty stories over the past couple of weeks, and we'll go in chronological order, beginning with the rejection of the long deliberated Google Books settlement. You know, I feel like we need that harp we've occasionally used here on the podcast to signal us going back in time, but. Unbelievably, this lawsuit was filed on September 20th, 2005, by the Authors Guild, who filed a class action lawsuit in the Southern District of New York against Google, after Google began digitizing libraries wholesale a year before in 2004, and then launched the book search, which of course allowed people to see snippets of books, including copyrighted books. And eventually, I think a month later, the American Association of Publishers filed another lawsuit against Google. And then they moved into settlement negotiations. And here we are many, many years later. And I think we have probably discussed this on, I don't know, two-thirds, three-quarters of the Digital Campus podcasts?
Certainly, at least half.
Okay, at least half. Well, we won't use the harp and go back in time, but I guess where we are now is the settlement's rejected and we are in limbo. Mills, what did you make of this, and what do you think the possible outcomes are? I mean, it seems at this point that Google won't be able to, for instance, show what are often called orphan works, or these works, many of them from the 20th century, millions of them, in fact. It's likely that over half of the Google Books collection is orphaned. In other words, we can't find the author or the publisher or the rights holder to actually get some kind of official sign-off on showing these things online. What happens next? Mills, what's your take? And I think this relates to what we were discussing about the DPLA on the last podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that worries me is that what's going to happen is that, because the scanning's already done, and so it's a resource, and it's a marketable resource. It can't be marketed in the way that they were planning on, at least according to this decision. So why not then create a subscription database and then close it off from general use and make it available only to paying customers? What would that be possible? In the same way that, you know, ProQuest Historical Newspapers has done, you know, has done scholars a valuable service by digitizing all these newspapers, but only the people who have access to libraries that have paid the subscription fee can actually use that resource. You know, from my perspective, one of the things I was always enthusiastic about with Google's project was the accessibility of all these orphan works. And so I'm not as thrilled about this aspect of the settlement. I'm afraid it's going to, you know, sort of limit our access to information, which, well, it'll just be like the good old days where we had to go to a library and try to find it and hope that the thing that you wanted was in that library. I don't think we're going back that far, but it does worry me that all this information is available and we can't, at least in the current settlement, have access to it.
Yeah, well, Judge Denny Chin said in the settlement that basically both parties had overreached, right? The Google had overreached in essentially wanting, going forward, a kind of monopoly on a big chunk of our cultural heritage. And he said, you know, really that has to be given by an act of Congress, and obviously it shouldn't be given to a specific company. And on the other side, the two partners in the class action lawsuit, the Authors Guild and the AAP, the Association of American Publishers, he berated for, in some sense, really not representing a lot of authors, right? That didn't represent, for instance, academic authors who might want their works spread farther and in a more open fashion than your Stephen Kings of the world. But he said, to your point, Mills, that, well, maybe there's an easy solution, or at least one big part of the solution would be to amend the settlement to be opt-in. In other words, yes, as you said, Mills, there could be a for-pay database or for-pay individual copies, but it would have to be sanctioned by an author or publisher or rights holder saying, yes, I would like to participate in Google Books. Here, you have my right to do that, and I want some income from that. Is that a suitable outcome for you, Mills, or before we get to everyone else on this point? If it was just opt-in, but it was a much smaller database, let's say, of the couple million public domain works and then maybe a couple million opt-inners?
Well, it's better than nothing, but what about all the orphan works that we can't determine who has the copyright on, or the copyright holder's dead, or the company's gone out of business? I mean, I give you a very specific example that I know well, and that is that one of the best publishing houses in Eastern Europe during the communist period, during the pre-war period, was a Czech company called Milantrik, which is back, but it died at the end of during the Second World War, and all of the works that it owned went into, you know, the company went out of business, and so therefore didn't hold the copyright anymore. The company was resurrected after the communist period, and the hiatus was too long for them to reclaim the copyright for those works, and so they're just floating out there in libraries in the Czech Republic and a few other places, that with, you know, no one having a claim on the copyright. And so, you know, eventually Google or somebody like Google would get around to scanning those works, but nobody can say, I'm going to opt in. They're all dead.
Right. God, it's incredible how many works fall into this category. By most accounts, about 2/3 of what Google has scanned, they've scanned about 15 million books. So 10 million books are just, you know, one by one, a lot like the books you've just mentioned.
My thought on it, I think the opt-in thing could work for those books for which it can work, not the example Mills gave. But I think actually the big outcome of this decision is that I don't think we're going to see the orphaned works problem decided in the courts. I think we've kind of, you know, that was the big attempt to decide this issue of orphan works, which is a problem legally. There's a problem there in the copyright law. And it just doesn't seem to me after this decision that there's a way to go forward in the courts where this big, you know, question mark in the copyright law and in digitization as it regards copyright is going to be solved in the courts. I think now, unless Congress steps in and does something about this, these orphan works, they're just going to remain orphaned and, you know, less than accessible to the vast majority of people. So I think that they probably will come to some agreement. I mean, Google's got all, you know, both sides have a huge interest in getting whatever they can out there online. And so I think they'll probably come up with something for these, you know, things that are, you know, clearly in copyright, where the copyright holders are known, and then clearly out of copyright pre-1923 works. But for those middle works, I just don't see how we're going to come to any solution under this, you know, under the current litigation. Or really, I can't imagine two other parties in some kind of lawsuit who could come to some settlement of this issue in the courts. So that's where I sort of see it. And sadly, I don't see Congress moving anytime soon on it.
I disagree with that, actually. One of the things I really love about this outcome is that Judge Chin's opinion kind of very specifically stated at a few points, this should not be settled in the courts. This has to be a matter for Congress. It is so wide ranging, you know, specifically the matter of orphan works. And there was legislation pending a couple of years ago where, you know, a law almost got passed that said, okay, you can digitize orphan works if you make a good faith effort to find the copyright holders and document the fact that you've tried to find them to ask their permission, and then you can't, and then you digitize it, you put it up, and you say, you know, tell me if this is your work and we'll do what we can.
But do you really think Judge Chin holds a lot of water with the United States Senate? I mean, Chris Dodd was just, another big copyright holder. Chris Dodd was just named the head of the MPAA. Do you think, like, you know, I don't see like Congress, you know, legislation can be introduced, but do you see Congress really caring and overriding the concerns of all the big copyright holders to make things better for the rest of us? I guess I'm not that optimistic.
I know. I'm a naive fool, Tom. Leave me that.
No. That's not what I'm saying. I just don't see Congress being very receptive to, like, you know, the concerns of academic researchers over the concerns of.
No. But see, this is the thing, is that I think it's actually, I'm definitely cynical enough to think that, yeah, the concerns of nonprofits, you know, cultural heritage institutions and academics are not going to sway Congress compared to the huge lobbies that corporate interests have. But that's exactly the thing, is that this would have been a really, really good commercial solution for a lot of people. And the fact that it has now, can't go forward in this way, seems to me that there are you know, there are commercial reasons to solve the orphan rights problem now.
Well,
right?
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. I hope they do take it up, because that is actually the real solution to this problem.
Right.
You know, it was never a good idea to try to settle this in the courts, I don't think. I think Congress should step in and make, you know, make a judgment once and for all. That's their responsibility and role in our system of government. So I hope you're right.
There are pieces of this that I think went a little bit unremarked in the popular media coverage, one of which is this research corpus. Part of the settlement was actually a pretty big deal for the four of us and others who work at the intersection of digital collections and scholarship. It made available an entire corpus, a very large, you know, multi-million dollar volume for digital research. That seems lost in the mix, although it's a little unclear. I mean, there are partners here with Google who are saying, well, they're going to kind of move ahead with research corpora anyway. It seems like HathiTrust, for instance, which holds millions of scans from Google Books, might move into something like a research corpus. Is this just small change in the bigger scheme of the copyright holders versus people who want access to this material, or is that something that you think we'll still have at some point in the future?
So, are you talking from the perspective, Dan, of somebody who's participating in the digging into data challenge well, you're thinking in terms
something
of
like that. I mean, you know, there was a pretty good argument, right, that Google and others made in the settlement that for non-consumptive use, was that awful term, but I guess it's the best one we have, for non-consumptive use, that is things like n-grams and text mining of very large databases, that it was actually okay to go ahead and get all that stuff into a database. So much seems to have just not been resolved, right, because of this. For instance, is that still okay? There were lots of copyright holders who said even creating that database, in fact, and the act of copying the books to begin with, that Google had violated even a fair use provision.
I'm in favor of this settlement having been rejected. Let's get that clear.
Yeah, as am I, right? There are big chunks of it that really should have been done right to begin with, like the Orphan Works legislation.
But I do agree with Mills, too, that it's going to be, you know, a sad thing for researchers, at least in the immediate future, whether you're talking about researchers who want to access a particular book or, you know, a few books, or whether you're talking about researchers who want to do sort of intensive data crunching on the entire corpus. But what I found was interesting about this rejection of the settlement was just sort of how far it had come from the original lawsuit, which, as you said, you know, was instigated back in 2005. I just finished reading Siva Vidyanathan's The Googleization of Everything, in which he kind of pointed out that the original thrust of the lawsuit was essentially a kind of a fair use argument, where Google sort of said that it decided to assume that it had the right to copy all of these books for the purpose of indexing them, for serving up these little snippets, right? So, you know, apparently that, you know, that does trigger copyright law in the sense that you're making copies of these books, but Google originally back in 2005 never sort of expressed any intention of selling the full copies of those books. And that's what the issue has come to turn around in the last little bit, you know, is that,
isn't that weird how when we first started talking about it, it really was revolved around that, right? Does an entity have the right to scan these things for search, retrieval, data mining, those sorts of things?
Right.
And then, but near the end, really, it did come about actually selling books. It became a bookstore, as Siva's pointed out. Yeah,
there are twists.
You gotta wonder if it wasn't a Trojan horse, too. I mean, you know, like I just wonder if that, you know, here I am, the cynic, but maybe that was Google's plan all along.
And we actually speculated about that on one of the early podcast discussions of this.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you have a better memory than I do. But
insert carp sound here. Yeah. Go back to the beginning. The thing is that I would have been in, you know, when this project came up back in 2005, I was on the side of, I think Google totally has the right to make full copies of these books, that it should be fair use, even if it isn't explicitly fair use, for the purpose of indexing them. And then, you know, you serve up a few lines around your search terms just so you can kind of see the context of what you're searching for. That I would have been in favor of.
Yeah.
But I'm frankly not in favor of Google having the rights, total control over the rights registry. That always bugged me, and I'm really glad that got shut down. Various other aspects of this.
Yeah, I mean, it is telling, isn't it, Amanda, that the title of the site, when you went to books.google.com, changed from Google Books Search to Google Books.
Right.
Right. I mean, it has made that full transition now, especially since the launch a few months ago of the Google ebook store. And that's a very different thing, right, than Google Books Search in the same way that they had Google Blog Search or Web Search or those sorts of things.
Yeah, Google Books Search is a very different entity from Google Books.
I seem to remember now that the harps are going off in my my head that, I think I said early on that I really never got the notion of why Google was moving into an area where they were a content provider. I mean, that was kind of odd for me, that for everything else that Google did in the first decade of their life, their existence, that they were the aggregator and information retrieval system for decentralized content. And so it always struck me, if there's going to be a Google Books or a Google Books Search, that it would be, you know, well, there are books at Michigan and Harvard and the Library of Congress, et cetera, that Google indexes and points you to, but then you go out to those decentralized sites. It was odd, right, when it became very centralized and then rather aggressive in its hoarding of things like orphan books.
Well, again, I'd have to say that Siva does a really good job with this in Googleization of Everything, of pointing out how Google is doing, I think he breaks it down into three different things. That he points out that Google Street View, for instance, is Google creating content, right? Google is taking pictures of the world and, you know, putting those up online, and that's a very different endeavor from indexing the web, you know, and that Google itself is involved in so many different kinds of activities that you can't, you know, sort of apply one set of laws to Google just because it's doing so many different kinds of things. And I think that's really true, that this is a case, Google Books, where it's creating digital content that wasn't there before, which is very different from what it does as a search engine or even as an ad provider.
I mean, I think a lot of these companies that weren't in the content business, like Google, that didn't start, Dan, I think you're right, didn't start in the content business, are converging on the content business from a lot of different directions. I mean, Apple was never in the content business, and they've converged on content through iTunes. You know, Amazon has always been in the content business, but then they've moved into other people's business areas through cloud services, moving into Google's business, and through devices, moving into Apple's business. So, you know, there are these big technology companies, and they're all kind of stretching out from their original, you know, core business areas into things like content. And I think they feel like they need to compete.
Okay, well, we don't want to beat a dead horse, but I think, again, as we've probably said over the last 6 years or 4 years of the podcast, and then 2 years before that, this is a story that will not die, and we're going to be back on it. It makes you feel like you need to be a lawyer to really dig into some of the meat of this, although I did think Chin's relatively short judgment piece was pretty clear and very readable about some of the issues. Well, speaking of being a lawyer about things, we have an exercise for our audience right now. Raise your hand, stand up, and raise your hand if you use your university-provided email address. Give everyone a second. Okay, count those up, Mills, Tom, Amanda. I'm seeing about 70% of people out there in the audience with their hands up. So we learned a very important lesson, didn't we, over the last week because of what happened to William Cronin, Bill Cronin, the great environmental historian who is at the University of Wisconsin and has recently started a blog called Scholar as Citizen, very good blog, and started that blog with a pretty in-depth report, including some original analysis of let's call it a legal group that seems to be providing boilerplate text for bills for mostly, or in fact entirely, Republican-leaning administrations in states to try to do things like pass labor reform. And Bill also wrote a op-ed for the New York Times disparaging what was going on in his home state of Wisconsin with Governor Walker and the unions there. Shortly thereafter, of course, the GOP in Wisconsin requested his emails, his email messages, because as a public employee of the University of Wisconsin, a public university, you are allowed to file FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, to get professors' emails. Mills, you're on the ball on these things. You must have known about this. What did you make of this when it came out, and what's your advice to our listeners?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, when I started my blog a long time ago now, I made a conscious decision that I was, A, going to put the blog on one of our servers, and B, that therefore I was going to stay completely out of politics. And because I'm a representative, if I'm using state resources, which our servers are, then, and I'm doing it during any of the blogging at all during my work hours, which I wanted to do, and so therefore I kept it within the bounds of what I do at work. I kind of consciously put a wall between me and anything political. And those of you who are friends of mine know that I have very strongly held political views on a whole bunch of things. And I just it's kept them at
all. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. So I just kept them out of the blog, and I stuck really to educational issues because of that. And there have been a number of times over the past 5 years where I've really wanted to use the blog as a platform to say something about an issue which is much more political. And I have always said to myself, well, yeah, but that's sitting on a state server, state-owned server. And so I really, if I want to do that, I'll start my own political blog and see if I can develop an audience that way. And that was always more trouble than I wanted to do. And so I kept it to myself. I think he may have a little bit of a problem given the nature of various legal decisions, and I'm no attorney, but given the nature of various legal decisions over the years of controlling things such as what happens when faculty members put their syllabi online. Well, if this happened, there was a ruling on this in Kansas years ago in the early days of the internet, that when University
what
of
happens
Kansas,
is Dan Cohen goes out and grabs them all and
exactly
the giant data.
Exactly.
That's what happens
without
that's,
permission.
That's exactly what happens. It's worse than Google when Dan does things like that. But
last night on Twitter, someone called me a hoarder. I'm like hoarding syllabi. I also have every newspaper since 1982 stacked up in my living room, but that's for another podcast. Sorry, Bills. Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, Bills.
Yeah. Well, the intervention will be not this weekend, but next weekend, Dan. So, we've squared it away with your family, and we'll all be there to help with the newspapers and to, anyway, sorry to our audience for digressing about Dan's personal issues. But, the decision at the time was that those syllabi that were posted online, they were posted on university servers using university-owned computers, which all belong to the taxpayers of the state of Kansas. And so, therefore, it was work made for hire. And those syllabi belonged to the state. They were not the intellectual property of the faculty members. And if I remember correctly, that same decision made a clear sort of drew a very clear line between teaching and research, which at the time bothered me because I don't make such a clear distinction between teaching and research. I think they're not that easy distinction that a lot of people would like. So research belonged to it was the intellectual product of the faculty member, where the teaching was the product of the state. So the question is then, if that is true, if I've represented that legal decision correctly, then Cronin may have a little bit of a problem, or he may not, because he may be able to argue that the things which he wrote on his blog, while political, were part of his life as a researcher, not part of his life as a teacher, and so therefore there's no issue there. I think it's obviously one that's going to get sorted out in court. But it reminded me when I saw it a little bit about what's happening here in our own state of Virginia about lawsuit between the state of Virginia and the state's flagship, the University of Virginia, over emails between an environmental researcher at UVA who's now at Penn State and colleagues over their own research on global warming. And this is still being resolved in the courts. There is no resolution yet. So I think it's murky.
Hasn't that always been the problem with, professors' work? It does exist in some way in this very weird state where, a lot of what we do, I think, writing books, things like that, it is considered our work. We take home the royalties from it. We expect that we can take our syllabi with us if we move universities, these sorts of things. It may technically be work for hire in some cases, although most universities consider things like writing a book to be your intellectual property. But it is very strange. And I think a lot of people were caught off guard that, something as simple as email, which a lot of us use very casually and everybody used their email for lots of different things. I mean, sometimes I have to use my email just to sign into services. To combine that with the real strong power of Freedom of Information Act requests, which often don't need to be deeply justified, they can be asked for by anyone. It sets up this the possibility of serious problems, doesn't it?
Right. I mean, I think the problem for me with this is I kind of don't know which side to be on. In a sense that You know, it sort of pits two kind of deeply held values that I have. One, which is, you know, transparency in government. And, you know, I am a strong supporter of freedom of information. And as a researcher, I think it's, you know, it's a vital tool for all of us to have. And for citizens, I think it's very important that, you know, our state employees and government employees and officials be held accountable for their actions. And the only way we can do that is through transparency. So on the one hand, I'm a strong supporter of freedom of information. On the other hand, I'm also a very strong supporter of intellectual freedom and the right of professors to, you know, think their own thoughts and publish their own thoughts and not be, you know, brought up on disciplinary actions or anything else for doing that, which is in fact their job, right?
Right.
So I don't see an easy answer to this problem.
Isn't the answer that just everyone, you know, I mean, students and faculty at this point, I think we've discussed this before on the podcast, I just don't see a reason why they need an official, you know, EDU email address in 2011 at this point. I mean, the problem is, as some people have pointed out, that, you know, there are some things that some universities actually force professors to use at their .edu domain for certain things like communications with students. But all the students are coming in now with Gmail or Yahoo or Microsoft email addresses. I mean, maybe just the technology is sort of passing by this realm. And maybe this will also happen with things like syllabi and course material as they move off of the, you know, campus IT units grid and onto the open web.
Right. I mean, that is the technical solution for it is, you know, have your own domain and host your own blog and host your own email and buy your own computer and do things that way. You know, I have heard some, you know, and I, again, you sort of need a lawyer to sort through all of this, but I have heard various opinions that, you know, even if you do some of those things, if you are performing, you know, if in the course of your state duties, if you're using personal email, then that even that personal email may be subject to FOIA requests. I mean, there's those kinds of issues that I think come up, and I think we'd need a lawyer to sort through those, and I think probably the courts need to sort through some of those as well. But yeah, I mean, I think that's at least it puts a layer between, you know, having your own domain, having your own email, puts a layer between you and someone, you know, seeking access to your email. At least they have to do more than, you know, send a scary sounding note to the university general counsel, who then will leave you a scary sounding voicemail on your phone asking for you to turn over your email, or possibly just going directly to central IT services and grabbing it. So yeah, I think having that layer between you and the administration and you and the rest of the world is an important thing to do.
I
thought there was an interesting aspect to this case. It's not a lawsuit yet, but to this event, which is the extent to which it has to do with academic freedom, which I'm not sure whether that applies. For instance, the AAUP did come out against this FOIA request for Bill Cronin's emails, saying that they thought it would be likely to impinge upon academic freedom. And Tom, you very rightly said that this this incident pits those two values against each other in a way. But for me, I have to say that I'm not. I'm not sure that you know that one's emails do sort of fall under, for me, the category of stuff that should be protected by the principles of academic freedom in a way. In fact, they're, you know, partly because they're more private than that. They're understood to be private communications, whereas for me, academic freedom suggests the freedom to, as you say, publish and to teach in a public classroom ideas one wants to teach. And I think, you know, as far as I know, Bill Cronin hasn't been censured at all by his university for that original blog post he wrote, sort of investigating this organization with ties to the Republican Party. As far as I know, nobody has said that was inappropriate or anything. It's just that the Republican Party has levied this FOIA request on his personal emails. And I more or less from my point of view, I think that while that is clearly a kind of an preparatory to being an intimidation tactic for Bill Cronin, I don't think it's in itself an attempt to impinge upon his academic freedom. I don't know if that's clear at all, but when I want to defend academic freedom, I really want to protect people's right to publish and to say things that they want to say. And as far as I know, that isn't really being affected yet. In fact, it's the opposite thing that he's being subjected to, is the requirement to make public things he didn't want to make public. So,
right. Yeah. And I mean, when they, in the dragnet, you sometimes get caught, as he's pointed out, some, more personal stuff, I assume, that, it's not embarrassing, let's say, but it's just stuff that you don't want all your emails out there in the world. So,
is an attempt to silence him, right? I mean,
this is a pretty aggressive move.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they are trying to threaten him into stopping to blog bad things.
Of course.
About.
Yeah.
Yeah. In effect, it is an assault on academic freedom in that sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the university is doing the right thing, but I think they are trying to make a point about, professors who are in state employ should not be bad-mouthing the GOP. And that then does become an academic freedom argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it hadn't gotten to that point yet. I mean, really, I don't know where it has happened, what's happened in the last couple of days, but, to the point that I read up about it, they had made the request for his emails, which was a very unusual request. I mean, let's be clear about that. Usually, it's journalists making FOIA requests.
That's right.
For things. And so what I thought was very, very smart of Bill Cronin to do was to blog about it.
Yep.
I mean, and I love the fact that he had started a blog just recently, and you're like, okay, you are now a public intellectual. This is what it's about, when you're blogging. And I sort of love that aspect of it, that he had just now started a blog and is a hugely public figure. But what he did was to say, hey, they asked for my emails. Clearly this was an intimidation tactic,
Yeah. Well, and the
here's
other thing is,
but they hadn't done that.
Yeah, the other thing is, were they to ask for my emails, it would take forever for me to turn them over, because I have nonstop correspondence with students about their academic work. And all of that is private to the students, is protected information under FERPA. And so no private citizen has the right to that information.
Right. And he made that point, too.
Yeah.
The other thing I'll just mention here is I also wonder, though, if this has less to do with Bill Cronin and his particular post, and a lot of this is and this is politics. It's not necessarily law, and it's not necessarily academic issues of academic freedom according to university codes of conduct and policies and all of that. I mean, this is politics. And I wonder if really what the GOP is trying to do is not so much to intimidate Bill Cronin into shutting up, is to intimidate the rest of us into shutting up. I mean, it's really, in a sense, more of a statement than it is a real serious action, it seems to me.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's one thing, what's going to happen to Bill Cronin? Like, he said this in his post, like, okay, so, so worst comes to worst, Wisconsin fires him. So he goes to Stanford and makes even more money.
Right.
Like, that's the worst thing that's going to happen to Bill Cronin.
Do you think
they're
that
not
they
going to fire him? He's tenured.
Do you think that they know that?
Well, but even if they did, it wouldn't matter.
But do you think the Wisconsin GOP knew that he's the incoming AHA president, American Historical Association president?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, would that be more intimidating, or do you think that then they realize, with a gulp that, holy cow, this guy's going to have a giant mouthpiece next year, and as he's president of the American Historical Association, or maybe it plays right into their strategy because they could just paint him as, whatever.
Right. I guess that's what I'm sort of saying, the latter, that maybe it's more like this is less about Bill Cronin and what he wrote. This is more about Fox News and the discussion on the O'Reilly factor about those liberal professors. So I just wonder if it's a cultural move to intimidate those with liberal leanings into not saying.
But isn't this very dangerous for conservatives, liberals, or moderates in terms of now cluing people into the fact that they can make these FOIA requests? I mean, we could go out today and make lots of these things. We don't have to give a reason. I mean, you have to be specific. You can't ask for every email by every professor. But, you know, I don't know, if you were a liberal group, you could now go out and, you know, ask for, here at George Mason, we have a very libertarian econ department, and we could ask for, you know, a bunch of their emails related to libertarian policy and the Tea Party. I mean, it just,
or some of the, or some of the you could go after, I mean, some of the Bush, the attorneys in the Bush Justice Department who were, you know, doing, you know, all of the interrogation stuff, all of those memos, they're now at, you know, the biggest law schools in the country.
Right.
You could go after there.
Yeah.
Know,
it seems like Berkeley. A very slippery EU slope email. That I don't think really anyone wants to go down. I mean,
I'm inspired now, because what I want is our economist Tyler Cowen's notes about all the ethnic restaurants that he visits and blogs about.
Yeah, no kidding. Is Tyler Cowen using his personal email to discuss tacos?
If he is, then boy, do I want those notes, because his blog on ethnic restaurants in the greater Washington, D.C. area is as good as it gets.
Yeah, everyone out there, we'll link to it from the digitalcampus.tv website. But Tyler Cowen is a really esteemed economist. But on the side, he's an even better restaurant reviewer and seems to find every single out-of-the-way little taco stand at the Shell station in rural Maryland, which he claims, I don't know if you guys saw that, but he has found the best taco place in America. It's at a gas station in rural Maryland. So I don't know if really anyone, including, you know, the people taking this action, think that, you know, if you really think more broadly, what these FOIA requests usually are from journalists who are exploring, like, what the athletic department does at the University of Wisconsin, not what a professor does. And that leads to a whole bunch of potential problems.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if we are going to enter in on that brave new world now, which is going to be a terrible new world. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, people on the left start making these kind of individually aimed FOIA requests as well.
Yep. I mean, why not, right?
Right.
Becomes a tit-for-tat sort of a thing.
Well, and I do like your point, Dan. I mean, I tend to go for the kind of pragmatic, moral, what can I as an individual do? And I have said for a long time that really, I try never to put anything in email that I wouldn't want to be public, at least in terms of content. Right. I guess I am a little bit uncareful with sending things like passwords and bank information through secret email accounts that you would never hack into.
Sure. You know, interestingly enough, Amanda, yesterday I released all of your email as a corpus on the web.
And I'm actually proud of that.
Amanda, 1 million Amanda French emails
available. And if you are listening to this podcast now, because why else would you be hearing this, and you received an email from my wife yesterday saying that she was in London, had been mugged, and needed money, do not send that money. Because her email got hacked, and that email went out to everybody in her contact list, which the hackers, these were enterprising hackers, because they also deleted her contact list and all of her email so that she couldn't then figure out who the email had gone to. And she had previously been the president of our children's elementary school PTO, so there were a lot of people on her contact list.
Oh, goodness. That just sounds awful.
So she did not get mugged in London. She's still in Virginia. Don't send money.
OMG. That's all I have to say. And I'm saying it because it is now a favored word from the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary.
I know, right?
Yeah, it made it.
LOL.
LOL to that OMG. Now, why didn't they announce this on April 1st? We're recording here the day before April Fool's Day, luckily. Otherwise, you wouldn't believe anything we say, which you probably should do anyway. But end of civilization, Amanda, or just the day before the end of civilization?
No. I think people in you'll never find me being on the William F. Buckley side of grammatical prescriptivism. I think language is an ever-evolving entity, and I applaud the Oxford English Dictionary for its willingness to add colloquialisms such as LOL and OMG. In the news stories about this, they mentioned that, you know, these terms, words, acronyms, whatever you want to call them, are used in not only online contexts, like you can find them actually in print books, and that they are evocative of a certain online frugality, an informal gossipy mode of expression, to quote the OED announcement. And so I think they're perfectly valid. I'm very happy to see that internet speak is being recognized by a venerable
What makes internet speak recognized by the dictionary, though, is that when it appears in print, it becomes somehow validated. That I don't like. I'll be William F. Buckley. I live in Connecticut now.
That's right.
For a minute, I don't have a problem with putting new words in the dictionary. That I'm okay with. I have a problem with putting new acronyms in the dictionary. that's my problem with all of this.
But I think they've translated. They've transcended the acronym mode, I think, in the case of LOL and ONG.
I guess.
Yeah, and it's
Hey, do you know what word didn't make the OED this year, but did make the American Dialect Society's number one ranking as the word that least likely to succeed?
No.
Think it through. Culturomics.
Really?
Yes.
With
over 50% of the vote.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Well, hooray. Yeah. Everybody hates culturomics.
In fact, the American Dialect Society said they didn't even know how to pronounce it, and they are language professionals. Like, is it omics or is it omics? Because it's from genomics.
Well, one of the criticisms of that project is that there weren't enough humanists on the author list, and maybe if they had had a linguist on their list, they wouldn't have made that mistake.
Actually, they probably have the most famous linguist in the world on that.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
In a world where iPad and Streak are accepted names of gadgets, I think we're going to find that culturomics is not so bad.
Well, and you know, I'm going to be on Amanda's side on this one, because I, for years, have wished that there was a dictionary of 19th century Czech abbreviations. Because who knows what these abbreviations mean in the letters that I read? I mean, yeah. It's just... It drives me batty to not have, I mean, because they, first of all, they're abbreviations that have fallen out of use. And second of all, for me, they're in a language which I don't use as well as I could. And so I just have no hope of figuring these things out. And you can just visualize for a minute Professor Kelly picking up the document from his table and walking over to the archivist and saying, excuse me, but do you have any idea what that three letters with a period stands for? And I'll be back in an hour to ask you for another one.
Right.
So if there were such a dictionary, I would buy it.
So the OED has done us a service then.
You know, it's funny. I can remember a few years ago, people getting very excited about the Urban Dictionary in a way that we've forgotten to be excited about the Urban Dictionary, but I actually think the Urban Dictionary is an amazing research resource, even though, you know, you find a lot of, how shall I say, colloquial language in the Urban Dictionary. That's exactly what it's for. But, you know, it's an amazing resource. It's a crowdsourced dictionary.
Yeah.
We forget to be excited about that, and it's one that really does track slang, you know, on this minute-to-minute basis that we've never had before. So.
Right.
Not a new project, but I'm still excited about Urban Dictionary.
Yeah, and the definitions are quite good, aren't they? Yeah. Well, here's hoping that the 2012 edition of the OED includes the phrase digital campus, and we'll see you next time on another edition of the podcast.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.